You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, February 24th, 2010, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
And it was February 24, 1968, when Nature magazine carried the announcement of the discovery of pulsars.
Big day in science.
Wow.
1968.
You know what they did when they discovered that? They thought that they might come from an extraterrestrial intelligence, so they actually called these pulsars they found. I think they found two of them, LGM-1 and LGM-2 for Little Green Man 1 and Little Green Man 2.
Little Green Man.
Yeah, nice. Little Green Man. Yeah, that's I remember that's funny until I realized, no, this is natural.
Right, it's basically a rotating neutron star spewing out radio waves.
Yeah.
Because of the magnetic field, right, Bob?
Pretty much, yep.
So there you go.
Rebecca has the night off because she's sleepy.
Sleepy time.
Who isn't sleepy?
It's sleepy time.
Then again, it's 8:41 here and it's 12:15 there or 2. So it is later where she is.
Yes, it is.
Sweet dreams, Rebecca.
But speaking of the UK, there was some very interesting news. The House of Commons Science and Technology Committee, which was actually just put into existence in October of 2009, put out their second systematic review of a topic that is being supported by the UK government. In this particular case, homeopathy. So the name of the report is Evidence Check 2, Homeopathy. And they essentially say that homeopathy is completely worthless and the National Health Service should stop funding it completely.
Awesome.
Whoa.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really amazing. You know, for a political report to come out with such a really hardcore scientific conclusion was very
gratifying.
Yeah, very gratifying. In fact, seriously, if I wrote this report myself, it wouldn't be much different than what they wrote. I mean, they really hit a lot of very important themes, going beyond just saying, you know, if you review the evidence, homeopathy doesn't work. They also went through the principles of homeopathy, like cures like, and the more you dilute something, even beyond the point where there's anything left, the stronger it gets. And correctly concluded that these were implausible and were out of step with basic science. They pretty reasonably discussed the relationship between plausibility and utility in medicine, although they could have been a little bit stronger there. And then they acknowledged that homeopathy does not work any better than the placebo effect. And here's, again, where they really covered a lot of solid basic principles. They said, but it's not enough that something has a placebo effect. That's not enough to justify, you know, spending money on it or, you know, or formally endorsing it. And they essentially rejected the whole notion of placebo medicine, of just, you know, using modalities simply for their placebo effect. They also addressed the question of whether or not we should do further research into homeopathy. And again, they got it exactly right. They said, there has been enough testing of homeopathy and plenty of evidence showing that it is not efficacious. Competition for research funding is fierce, and we cannot see how further research on the efficacy of homeopathy is justified in the face of competing priorities.
That is perfect.
So basically, yeah, we've researched it enough. These are limited resources. Yep. There's no reason to throw more money after this 200-year-old, discredited, pre-scientific, you know, failed system. We're done. Just get rid of it.
No prior plausibility.
Wow, that's really uncommon.
Wait, is it April 1st or no? It's not April 1st.
No.
Sorry, Jay, pinch me.
Do they celebrate that?
And wait.
It's more of a spank than a pinch.
The whole point of this committee is to promote more evidence-based government, right? Mm-hmm. The purpose, they write, the purpose of evidence check is to examine how the government uses evidence to formulate and review its policies. So they want policies to be based on actual scientific evidence. Imagine that.
Steve, was there one particular person that brought this about, or was it done by committee?
It's a committee. It's the Science and Technology Committee, and comprised of lords of the House of Commons, like, you know, the equivalent of senators, or House of Commons, I guess, would be representatives. But still, I mean, it's just politicians.
Politicians are getting the science right.
Unbelievable.
They took testimony from both sides, and they specifically quoted Edzard Ernst multiple times. So I suspect that he had a profound influence on this report. You know, Edzard is a professor of complementary and alternative medicine who is essentially, after honestly and in-depth looking at the evidence, has come over to the science side, if you will, and you know, essentially has said there's really no evidence for homeopathy and a lot of other modalities as well.
Wow.
So
Prince Charles is having a bad day.
Yeah, he'll be very, very unhappy.
Hey, Stephen, do you know what this reminds me of a little bit? This reminds me of when we had the Dover trial and Judge Jones basically
knocked it out of the park,
crushed the creationists in a sense. So this was political. I don't want to say political correctness,
it was good. I agree. In fact, I made the same analogy, Evan, because when you're in this kind of a scenario where there are rules of evidence and you have people who understand evidence, hopefully, you know, they could see through the BS and can come to a reasonable decision. They also recommended that the MHRA, which is the British equivalent of the FDA, that this is a good sentence. We conclude that the MHRA should seek evidence of efficacy to the same standard for all the products examined for licensing which make medical claims. And we recommend that the MHRA remove all references to homeopathic provings from its guidance other than to make it clear that they are not evidence of efficacy.
Wow.
So they understood the difference between provings, which are how homeopaths figure out that whatever substance they start with is supposed to cause or prevent some symptom. It's not the kind of clinical trial that would demonstrate that it's effective for anything. And they also, they endorse this sort of single standard of evidence for medical claims, the kind of things that we've been saying for years.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really spot on in just so many ways. It's shocking. Now, of course, the homeopaths and the CAM advocates are not happy, and they trotted out the usual non sequiturs. So from the Times Online, a man by the name of Robert Wilson, who is a chairman of Nelson's, which is Britain's largest manufacturer of natural healthcare products, said, "There is good evidence that homeopathy works beyond placebo, for example, in animals and babies." And that is simply a misconception. It's a myth that you can't have a placebo effect in animals and babies because they don't – it's taking this very simplistic notion that the placebo effect is purely based on the expectation of benefit from the treatment, and that therefore, since babies and animals don't know what's going on, they can't have that expectation, they can't have a placebo effect. But that's nonsense. That's a really naive, simplistic notion of the placebo effect. It's really multiple effects, which includes non-specific benefits of just getting therapeutic attention. It's expectation of the observer as well. I mean, who is deciding that the baby or the animal is getting better? That person is where the placebo effect can be. So the notion that there isn't a placebo effect as measured by a clinical trial when you're talking about babies or animals is ridiculous and is just incredibly naive. And it absolutely does not mean that that homeopathy works for any of those indications.
Well, Steve, I don't think it's that far-fetched to think that a lot of people assume the placebo effect has to do with the patient thinking they're getting medication.
That is a very common myth. It's just, you know, a medical person shouldn't have that simplistic understanding, though.
Right.
Right?
Absolutely.
I would say, to add to that point, from what I've read and my understanding of it, it is a significant part of the placebo effect, correct?
What is?
The awareness of the patient believing that they're receiving a real medication.
It's a component of it. It's not an essential component. You can have a placebo effect completely separate from that. It's not generally mind over matter. It's more of an illusion because of nonspecific effects or artifacts of how you're looking for a benefit.
Steve, you wrote in the article, this fellow Michael Dixon, medical director of the foundation, said, "Science is a vital tool in healthcare, but so are compassion and caring in treating patients with dignity." Right, as if you can't have one with the other. It's totally impossible.
Total false dichotomy. To completely assumes that somehow saying that homeopathy doesn't work, lacks compassion or caring? That's a non sequitur. In fact, I think that he mentioned the word dignity. I think one of the greatest violations of patient dignity is abusing the informed consent by lying to them. You are taking from them their dignity and their autonomy, their informed consent. So this is just, again, turning the world upside down, which is what a lot of CAM proponents do, like to turn this logic on its head. So this guy also said, for patients suffering from long-term disease where no scientific evidence-based medicine can offer effective treatment, it does not matter how it works. What matters to them is whether they get better, whether pain and other symptoms are alleviated. But that's begging the question, right? That's if we because we don't have a treatment that works doesn't mean that something else does work. It doesn't mean that the patients are actually getting better. If it doesn't work, you're not doing patients any benefit by giving it to them. Now, this is just a recommendation. This isn't law. We don't know what's ultimately going to come of this, but it's definitely something to keep an eye on. I just like the whole concept of having a committee of people who clearly did a good job in this case, who are asking the question, you know, what should the relationship be between scientific evidence and government policy? That's a really good question.
Man, how great would it be if they just kept going in that vein of thinking?
In another sense, it's a little sad that all of us are so happily shocked because we should be seeing,
right.
You know, we should be seeing more of this all the time, and we're not.
This should be the standard, not the exception that gets our attention. Exactly, Bob. Tell us about what Darwin got wrong.
This is a book. It's been in the news lately. The authors are Jerry Fodor, a professor of philosophy and cognitive sciences at Rutgers University, and Massimo Piattelli Palmarini, a Paisan professor of cognitive science at the University of Arizona.
That's not our Massimo.
No, there's other Massimos, Jay. I think there's a few of them.
I think that's a very common name in Italian.
Mamma mia.
The first red flag about this book for me was that the authors don't appear to have any training in biology or anything else really related to evolution. Now, this in and of itself, of course, doesn't necessarily mean they have no insight to impart. But their lack of insight into evolution, however, is amply demonstrated by what they actually say about evolution. So the crux of their argument is, Jerry Fodor has stated the following. He said, "It's a main claim of our book that when phenotypic traits are endogenously linked, there is no way that selection can distinguish among them. Selection for one selects the others, regardless of their effects on fitness." So this means the following. Say 200,000 years ago, those humans that were faster survived longer to pass on their genes, right? Natural selection selected for this adaptive trait. So, but what if fast genes were linked to hairy butt genes? So if you have one trait, you'll almost invariably get the other trait. That's how it works most often. They come together as a genetic package. So the environment then selects for one trait that helps with survival, but brings along one or more separate traits that do not necessarily help with survival. So that's what they're saying with these phenotypic traits that are endogenously linked. So if Fodor and Palmarini are correct, then natural selection cannot distinguish between adaptive traits that are linked to non-adaptive traits. It's agnostic to it in a sense. It therefore cannot be an important mechanism for evolution. Have they then discovered a fatal flaw for their theory of natural selection? These guys are correct about the linked traits and having uneven benefit and how they are passed on. That's true. There's no problem with that. But the rest of their argument about natural selection reminds me of the following scenario. You have a botanist who writes an astronomy book claiming that spectroscopy, or the study of light waves, needs to be rethought because objects moving toward or away from us would affect the frequency of the radiation that hits us, right? In other words, redshift and blue shift. So that's kind of what happened here.
That's a really good analogy, Bob.
Right? So the answer to both books, the real evolution book and the fake astronomy book that I just made up, then would be the same. No duh.
No duh, right? Right. And P.C. Myers also does an excellent job of pointing that out, where it's like, we kind of figured this out about 80 years ago.
Oh, no. not 80. 97 years ago.
Oh, was it 97?
Yes.
And that's already been incorporated into the modern synthesis.
Absolutely.
Between genetics and evolution. You know, and
right.
The fact that these guys are just realizing it is kind of embarrassing.
But where the hell have they been?
Studying philosophy and cognitive science.
Exactly.
They haven't taken
that
class yet. Yeah.
I mean, the idea, the concept has a name. It's called linkage. You know, it's been a key part of the genetics for a century. Now, I'm not saying that everyone should know this concept, but if you're an evolutionary biologist or a geneticist involved with that, you know this. Two guys, Sturdivant and Morgan, they worked out this idea in 1913. Hello, I mean, it's been around, you know. And then Steve mentioned the modern synthesis. That's correct. In the 30s and 40s, modern evolutionary thought was fused together from the various biological disciplines that had drifted apart, like you had paleontology, botany, morphology, a few others, plus genetics. They were kind of moving away from each other a bit, and they kind of brought them all back into the fold and all communicating together. And linkage was a core component of genetics back then, and it was an important part of this modern evolutionary synthesis that happened in the 40s. Sometimes you'll see people will call this neo-Darwinian synthesis. So do these guys really think that evolutionary biologists believe every trait, every single trait is selected for? To me, this makes the whole book essentially one huge straw man, right?
Yeah.
They also found out that water runs downhill. It's amazing.
Now, the thing that it always interests me because, you know, I confess that from early on in my days of studying evolution, I was a big fan of Stephen Jay Gould. And Gould, along with Richard Lewontin in 1979, wrote an article criticizing the hyper-adaptationalist program within evolutionary biology. Essentially making that same point, Bob, that you know we shouldn't try to find an adaptation for every single thing that we see in nature. There's lots of reasons why traits come along for the ride, whether it's linkage or just genetic drift or just whatever. There's lots of quirky, historically contingent reasons. There are plenty of constraints, for example. Sometimes a trait's not quote-unquote linked, but it has advantages and disadvantages, you know?
Right.
So they dispelled this hyper-adaptationalism 31 years ago, right? And yet I keep hearing over and over again critics of Darwinism or evolutionary biology, again, criticizing it on the basis of ridiculous hyper-adaptationalist assumptions. It's essentially, as you say, Bob, it's just it's a very common straw man attack of modern evolutionary thinking.
But you might, some people I'm sure are wondering, well, then how does natural selection work with linkage, though? How does this really work out? And I think, tell me if I'm doing this justice, Steve, the general idea is that natural selection evaluates the traits as they are presented as a package. If the sum of a suite of traits raises the fitness level, then that suite is adaptive. It doesn't matter if only one of those traits has any real benefit.
The other thing to keep in mind that is even when two traits are genetically linked, they are not forever linked. They can be separated. It's just unlikely. The closer two genes are together, the more likely they are to sort together when the chromosomes are divided up, you know, among the gametes, right? It's maybe rare, but it will occur that even genes which are linked because they're right next to each other will at some point in time be separated.
Yeah, right? And that's a good point. And I just wanted to end with a P.Z. Myers quote. He did a good take on this on his blog, but this one kind of made me laugh. He said, this is what makes Fodor and Palmarini's ideas so embarrassingly bad. They seem to know next to nothing about genetics. And so when they discover something that's been taken for granted by scientists for almost a century, they act surprised and see it as a death stroke for Darwinism. I mean, that's pretty right. much it in a nutshell.
You know, there's another aspect of this whole thing that PZ gets into as well, Bob, where the whole mathematical construct thing where
Fibonacci sequence.
Fibonacci sequences, saying that because there's this mathematical regularity in nature and that evolution can't explain that, and PZ points out that, well,
what?
But if you actually understand evolutionary developmental biology, which is his specialty, it makes perfect sense because DNA is not a blueprint. Right, it's not a blueprint. It's a set of instructions for how to build a person, but it's not a blueprint of a person. It's this is the sequence that you follow, and some of those sequences will result by necessity in mathematical outcomes.
Right, like for the Fibonacci, you've got a series of cells that activate cells that are right next to it. And then you have all those cells activating the cells that are near them, and so on and so on. And that's the Fibonacci sequence right there. That's why the Nautilus shell looks the way it does.
Yes, exactly. But anyway, so it's disappointing. I think, you know, you wonder, were they just trying to grab headlines? It seems like a cheap ploy these days to say that Darwin was wrong, you know. But you know what? We're 150 years out from the origin of species, and evolutionary science has advanced quite a bit. Darwin didn't know about genes.
Hello, know. Yep.
Yeah, right.
Let me give you a quote from, just to close off this section, from Ned Block and Philip Kitcher. They wrote a review in the Boston Review. And this, again, I think also sums it up pretty well. Apparently unshaken by withering criticism of Fodor's earlier writings about evolutionary theory, they write with complete assurance, confident that their limited understanding of biology suffices for their critical purpose. The resulting argument is doubly flawed. It is biologically irrelevant and philosophically confused.
Yeah, I read that too. That was good.
Yeah. Let's go on. Very quickly, I want to talk about the Bloom Box. Mainly because this was the topic about which we got by far the most emails in the past week. So clearly a lot of our listeners saw this on 60 Minutes or heard about it and were very interested in it. And we like covering energy production type news items because they're always interesting to think about. The Bloom Box essentially is a type of generator. It is a fuel cell. It is made of a ceramic plate with two different kinds of material essentially painted on either side, and then you put them together in a stack, and then you feed some kind of fuel into one end, like natural gas, or I guess you could, or hydrogen, plus oxygen, and then you get electricity and carbon dioxide and heat out the other end, right?
That's, or a little bit of water maybe, too? What's your
or whatever the byproducts are of the of. If you put in natural gas, you're going to get CO2. If you're putting in hydrogen, you're going to get water at the other end, right?
Right.
I don't know if it can run off of hydrogen. It can run off of natural gas, definitely. So, you know, the way 60 Minutes covered it, you know, they didn't really put it in its proper context. First of all, this technology is old. This has been around for decades. You know, fuel cells are really nothing new. What's supposed to be at least innovative about this is its efficiency. It's supposed to be a highly efficient way to generate electricity. The other thing that's interesting about this kind of technology is that it could be, at least the company plans on making small, cheap versions of it that could be appropriately priced and powered for the home. So where this is interesting, again, not a source of energy. That's just to be clear. This is not, you know, don't confuse this with solving our energy problems or being a source of energy. You're still burning fuel, right? If every home had one of these, that means we'd have to be pumping natural gas into everyone's home. If they were burning hydrogen, we got to get the hydrogen from somewhere, which would require energy. Theoretically, it could be a way of storing energy, but I don't think these were really terribly efficient batteries, if you will. So essentially, this is a generator. Now, the role this could play is in decentralizing or distributing power generation. Interestingly, the reason that we went to the current system we have, where we have highly centralized remote power generation and then a grid of, you know, high tension wires and high voltage wires, you know, pumping that electricity to the areas where it's used, is because many of the forms of energy production, like coal-burning power plants, produce a lot of pollution. And we don't want to have a coal-burning factory pumping out pollution in the middle of a city. So we put it way out in the boonies and we pump the electricity in. However, if we could make efficient and relatively non-polluting power generators, then that creates the opportunity to generate the electricity closer to its point of use. This has a couple advantages. One is that there's less energy loss from transmission. Do you guys know how much electricity is lost in transmission? You know, just on average.
60%?
No.
Yeah.
No. So it's 7% or something? Or
7.2%.
Yeah.
See that? I was so damn close.
It adds up. I mean, it adds up. That's a lot. That's a lot of energy in the course of a year.
Yeah.
But it just floats away. Yeah.
Yeah. So if we could reduce that to 1 or 2%, you know, that's, you know, 5% or so savings of electricity is pretty good. But here's the other thing, though, which might have more of a factor, and that is when you produce energy remotely, there's a lot of waste heat. Yeah. Now, you know, modern power plants try to recapture some of that heat and use that for more power generation. They try to be as efficient as possible, but still there's some heat wasted. And then, so if you think about it, we make electricity, produced waste heat, which then just gets vented to the environment. We then pump, you know, send the electricity to a remote location where it's used to make heat. right? If you're heating your home in the winter, for example.
Oh, so you could pipe the actual heat into your house
if
it's local.
Exactly.
So send a pipe in.
So if you're – or just like if you have an office building and you have a generator in the office building that's producing waste heat, you can use it to heat water year-round or heat air in the cold months. That is a little extra layer of efficiency that you can get as well. Of course, if it's natural gas, there's inefficiency in pumping natural gas too, which is about 2 to 3%, so it's less. But there is some energy lost in pumping gas as well, just not as much. And, you know, we kind of take for granted that we pump natural gas into people's homes, and, you know, it's not like we're worried that your house is going to blow up or whatever. It's actually pretty safe, pretty reliable. But these machines, these power generators would have to be really safe. So again, something to keep an eye on, but not really the revolutionary news that I think 60 Minutes was trying to make it out to be. So, Evan, your Uri Geller was in the news recently.
I know. Can you believe it? I don't know what happened to him in the last few years. Now, was it about a year ago, perhaps 2 years ago, he came clean, as it were, and all but admitted that he really didn't have psychic powers, that perhaps he was just, you know, doing some tricks and...
Well, he didn't really fully admit that, but he backed off from overtly claiming to be being psychic to being coy, to being, who knows, you know, but not admitting that it was fake, though.
So well, guess what? he's apparently turned another corner back to the, I think, the way... he used to be, or is used to being, I should say. So the headline reads, Uri Geller used psychic powers to help cops catch a suspect. Israeli spoon bender Uri Geller...
the guy's always going to be known as a spoon bender.
That's it. Well, he's in the news because he revealed how he used his psychic powers to help cops catching a suspect.
Oh, boy.
He was walking his dog on his five-acre home in... And all of a sudden, a couple of alleged drug dealers, I guess they turned out to be, they ran onto his estate. They were fleeing from police, and the pursuit took place right into his house or right into his yard. So the police came, and there was a helicopter that hovered overhead, and, you know, and Uri's kind of, I guess, you know, I have no idea what's going on here. But in any case, there were two suspects. One of them was caught. And the other, you know, disappeared, or they couldn't find him. They lost his trail. But thank goodness Uri has used his powers once again. He found where the other criminal was hiding. It turns out he was hiding in the shed.
Mm-hmm.
And according to the quote, Uri said, "I followed my instinct to the shed, and there he was. The method I used is called dowsing. It's like a sixth sense."
Oh.
Everybody has a sixth sense, but most of us don't unlock it.
What an opportunist.
He basically said he used his magic powers to find the other guy, hiding on his property.
Right.
Yes.
Now, of course, there's no chance that because he was walking his dog that he might have seen the general direction that the other guy ran in. I mean, it's possible that he even saw him go into the shed. You know?
there's 100 explanations.
It's a completely uncontrolled situation. And if magicians are good at anything, it's being opportunistic. It's using the quirky details of a situation to make it seem like, you know, they have an ability that they don't have. But he got his name in the headlines again.
Well, why would the press even pick up on this
story?
Because
it's Uri Geller. Well, thanks, Evan.
No problem.
So, Evan, tell us about Who's That Noisy from last week.
Well, the best thing to do is to first play it, and then we can talk about it.
Alrighty.
Are you ready?
Yep.
Here we go.
However, scientists tell us that it will be many years before space travel becomes a reality.
Well?
And that was...
Walt Disney.
Walt.
It was When You Wish Upon a Star, Walt Disney. Walt Disney had a series of shows that he produced in the 1950s. From his, it was called the Tomorrowland series, in which they would talk about things like space travel and how the atom works and so forth. And these were all tie-ins, obviously, to promote his amusement park.
So this was in the 1950s, and he said it was going to be many years before we put people into space.
He was right.
Well, Nettie's kind of
no,
vague.
No, he wasn't right. Yeah. You know, you have Walt Disney on, and he said, "And here to explain further about the atom is Dr. Heinz, you know, Doofenshmirtz." You know,
yeah. Heinz Doofenshmirtz on there?
You know, but I'm just using that as an example. But a German scientist, you know, he would trot out the German scientist, basically, to talk about these things. And I'm thinking, that's such like a 1950s.
Cliche, kind of thing. Cliche. Yeah.
It is. You know, Dr. Strangelove, I thought about, yeah. You know.
Yeah. That's true. That's funny. Is that where the cliche of the German scientist comes from? Like after World War II, you know, the Soviet Union and the United States basically whacked up all the German scientists and took them for their space programs and whatnot. So.
We did. And their rocket technology that they were working on and all these other advancements.
Our Germans are better than their Germans.
Right.
It just smacks of the 1950s, too.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
Well, in any case, the first person to answer correctly was actually not from the message boards, although they answered relatively quickly there. But someone got to us on email first who answered correctly. That was Ryan from Portland, Oregon, was the first correct guesser.
Well, what do you got for this week, Ev?
All right. Here's this week's noisy.
That was a cricket.
Okay, there was a cricket in there. That's not the sound we're looking for.
Okay.
We want to know what is making that guttural...
roaring noise.
Yeah, roaring noise. It's not a lion, people. Don't guess lion.
Okay.
There's your hint for the week.
Okay.
Good luck, everyone.
All right, thanks, Evan. Well, we have a great interview coming up with Daniel Wilson. And I want to leave plenty of time for that, so let's go to the interview now. We are being joined now by Daniel Wilson. Daniel, welcome to the Skeptic's Guide.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Daniel is a roboticist and author of several wildly interesting geeky books, which we love. Editor of Popular Mechanics magazine, or a contributing editor, I should say, and also now the host of a History Channel show, The Works, which I've been watching and is quite fascinating. You wrote a couple of books that I think we're going to focus on our interview tonight. One is How to Build a Robot Army, and the other one is How to Survive a Robot Uprising. Both topics we've actually touched before on our show, but you're an actual roboticist, so you could give us some more information than our speculations. So first of all, why don't you give us, I know you do this on your show, but give us a definition of what a robot is.
Well, you know, typically a robot has a lot of different definitions. It could be very broad. I define a robot as any mechanical artifact that can sense, think, and act. So it senses the environment using sensors like cameras or microphones. It thinks about what to do using some kind of computer processor usually. And then it acts in the world using end effectors. So it actually moves around or causes something to change. That's actually a really broad definition.
A computer then is a robot.
Or a fire alarm. You know, it senses the building, what's going on. It senses fire. Whenever it finds fire, it thinks about what to do and then either trigger an alarm or not. And then it triggers it and causes all the people to run out. So it's a pretty broad definition. It's sort of hard to pin down exactly what a robot is, really, because it's almost anything qualifies.
Yeah, so it doesn't have to move, doesn't have to be independent in any way. It just has to have those components that you mentioned.
Yeah, it's really just any kind of thinking artifact that's gonna make decisions and cause things to change. Really, it's sort of just a logical extension of tools, you know, just... tools get more and more complicated. They take over more and more of the job. And so robots are really just complicated tools, I think.
And you've talked a lot about how to approach problem solving and design in robots.
There's always two ways to solve a problem in robotics, which and this is actually something that, you know, I think is really interesting. You have the top down versus the bottom up. You can just throw a lot of sensors at the problem and record as much data as you can and then rely on high-level symbolic processing to sort it all out, you know. Or you can build a really elegant robot from the ground up that's going to maybe solve the problem just automatically. Like, so for instance, you could build a complicated sensory system that's going to watch a person go out to the mailbox and open it, and, you know, maybe a camera image, or you can just put a contact switch on the mailbox. You know, did it open, did it close? Another example is if you're building a robot that walks, right? You can either give it all kinds of range of motion and then try to find the perfect gait, you know, or you can just build a really great leg that automatically forces the robot to use one gait.
Love great leg.
So, you know, you hit it from the top and the bottom, but, you know, these are the two sort of approaches to building robots.
That's interesting because that's also the two approaches that our brain takes, right? And it sounds like you're sort of modeling that idea basically after, say, the human brain, where there are bottom-up systems that do things automatically with automatic, you know, circuits, and then there's top-down, the higher cognitive things that control the big picture and the context.
And I think that's the overall evolution of robotics as a whole really follows that system as well. So you have you know, at CMU, there's hundreds of roboticists, and they all specialize. So one team might be specialized on speech recognition, one team emotion recognition, one team gait recognition, or all these different things, you know, face, speech, all the stuff that the human brain does all at the same time. You know, there's different teams of people figuring out how to do all of that. And then eventually you want a system where you can put it all together, all this lower level machinery working together to feed into some kind of higher level executive process, you know, something more recognizable as a human-like intelligence, you know, making high level decisions, doing stuff that people do. You know, most of the stuff that's really hard for robots to do is the stuff that's really easy for us to do. And we think it should be easy for robots because we don't have to think about it at all when we do it because it's so ingrained in our brains. You know, stuff like recognizing when someone's really pissed off.
Yeah.
That's just got an inherent sort of survival benefit for people, and we do it really well. But for machines, it's a lot harder.
Yeah, that's why the initial artificial intelligence predictions, I guess in the 60s, was it? They thought, oh, wow, we're going to have human-level intelligence in no time because they made, you know, a chess or checkers computer that was somewhat advanced. But then it's the stuff in the background that really nailed them on it because it's so easy for us to do, but it's so hard to write from scratch and program into a computer, and we're still struggling.
Yeah, intuition is a really bad guide as to what's going to be easy or hard when you're building robots. I mean, you could say what's the most difficult, and I think that's the, you know, just the AI hard problem. It's got to be natural language. So to solve the natural language problem, which is basically to, for instance, if you want to pass the Turing test, right? So Alan Turing suggests this test where he says, well, you know, if you want to figure out whether a robot has human-level intelligence, why get all philosophical about it? Just talk to it. And if you can't tell that it's a robot, then for all intents and purposes, you know, it's got human-level intelligence. Who can tell the difference? Who cares, right? Why look inside the box?
Right.
Whenever all that really matters is what's on the outside. So in order to pass the Turing test, you typically need to be able to converse with a human being on pretty much any topic that a human being could cover. And you got to do it in a way that makes sense. And so solving this problem, just natural language, means that you suddenly have to have this context for everything in the world, you know, everything that a person can talk about. And what you realize really quickly with whenever you study language is that the actual words we use are really just these little signposts that are pointing to these huge areas of shared context. You know, all of us are embodied as human beings. You know, we have pretty much the same form factor. We've all got pretty much the same brain architecture. We have so much in common that we just take for granted that we're able to communicate with actually very little information. We're just pointing toward something that we both know already. And that's what language is. It's this little skim on top of all this shared context. And robots really aren't invited to that party. I mean, they don't have a childhood. They don't have this system of learning. They may not even be embodied the way we are, so they may not even get our metaphors about feeling up or feeling down and things like that. So to solve that problem, you really have to solve every other problem in AI.
But that would mean that you're trying to make a human-like robot, right? I mean, wouldn't you be able to just come up with the base knowledge that a robot would need that didn't particularly need to be human-like, though? Like, couldn't you just program it?
No, that's a – I'm with you 100%. I think robots are their own thing. I think that going crazy trying to make robots have human-level intelligence – is a little bit of a waste of time. It's really easy to make humans, you know? And we are what we are. And to try to force a mechanical synthetic architecture to recreate, the way, you know, the way we think, I'm not sure if that's really the best approach. You know, the saying, you don't force an airplane to flap its wings, you know?
But then there's the argument, the devil you know, right? If you create a human-like robot, then you could bribe it, you know, and say, please don't take over the world and kill all humans, and I'll give you this. You know, you might have a shot of preventing the robot apocalypse.
All right, now that we're on to that, Daniel, you wrote a book called How to Build a Robot Army, but which one did you write first, How to Build the Army or How to Survive the Uprising?
I wrote How to Survive a Robot Uprising while I was a grad student, and then I told my the chair of my department, the head of the department, about my book tour during a lunch, and then he told me that I needed to graduate before the book came out, and so that spurred a really hectic 9 months in which I finished my degree and defended. So How to Survive a Robot Uprising came out right when I was out of school. And I was actually, at the time, I was terrified that all the roboticists, all the scientists that I up to and respected would think that I was serious. that I was, you know, sounding the alarm that everything that we'd been working on was going to cause mayhem and kill everyone. So How to Survive a Robot Uprising is actually tongue in cheek. You know, it's in the humor section. It's got all real information, but the idea that there's going to be a robot uprising is kind of not something I take super seriously.
Because, you know, your two books are, you know, kind of go head to head with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, when I first looked at your website, I'm like, okay, so he wrote How to Build a Robot Army, that I'm looking down, and then the two books below it, it says How to Survive a Robot Uprising. I'm like, this guy's a marketing genius.
Yeah, those books are shiny, and you know, I've actually spent the last 6 months writing my first novel. so it's actually again about about people going through a robot uprising. It's just fun to think about, you know.
Daniel, your books remind me of Max Brooks's zombie books, you know, World War Z and the Zombie Survival Guide. And were you going for the same, you know, concept there, or?
Well, you know, I used to be sort of offended by the comparison, but I have made peace with it. I love those books too. And what I used to say is, you can't get a PhD in zombies.
Right.
But now I've mellowed out. You know, the Zombie Survival Guide, it never cracks a smile. It's the fact that the book exists is the whole joke. So it's a completely
right.
serious book. How to Survive a Robot Uprising is, you know, much more lighthearted. It's sort of filled with jokes. But, you know, human beings do love to imagine how they'd survive, you know, how they'd make it through these survival scenarios. You know, we like to think about it. It's probably, it's probably a good survival trait that we are intensely fascinated by threats, and especially, you know, human-like threats. I think there are similarities between zombies and robots and the reason that people are afraid of them, you know? So for one thing, there's nothing that's killed more human beings than human beings, you know?
Yeah.
We're our number one predator. We're our number one competition. And in a lot of pop culture, robots look like human beings, you know? Except they're off a little bit. and just like zombies. I mean, if you imagine an android that's walking around, it from the outside looks like a human being, but there's little things it doesn't get right. You know, it might not breathe, or it might not blink, or maybe its gait isn't so steady. You know, maybe it shambles along. Well, I mean, is it a robot? Is it a zombie? What is it? I mean, whatever's
underneath.
It could
be a ninja too. Don't ever forget that.
Is it a ninja in disguise? Is it a cyborg zombie? There are so many possibilities.
But Daniel, what you're saying though is that you don't think that our technology getting out of control and bringing down civilization is something that we need to stay up nights worrying about.
No. Yeah. What you said, I agree with.
Okay.
But I don't want to say, what I don't want to say is that robots aren't dangerous at all. I mean, clearly they're dangerous, especially if you're weaponizing them, then, you know, the whole definition is that they're dangerous. So, robots are really complicated tools. And when your tools start getting autonomous and making decisions on their own, they become very hard to predict. And whenever you have tools that are very complicated, very hard to predict, and possibly with shotguns attached to them, you might not want to, you might want to keep your eye on it. You might want to put a big emergency stop somewhere near.
Have you seen the sci-fi series Caprica by any chance?
I have read the script, but I haven't seen it.
So it's the prequel to this Battlestar Galactica, and basically it runs through a company building the first Cylons, right? So it's essentially taking brand new off-the-shelf AI and putting it into this massive steel, fully automated killing machine.
Yeah, a little RoboCop there.
Yeah, and you're thinking, why? And no one has the slightest bit of caution about doing this. I mean, that it seems like that would be that's the kind of thing we probably shouldn't do.
Well, yeah.
But do it in software first, right? Make it all software.
That was their problem. They did it in software. Wasn't their software a terrorist?
That's right.
they're like, let's take the terrorist software and let's stick it in a big Centurion. Yeah. Brilliant. Cigars for everyone. You know, I think that's a key. I've thought a little bit about when you're designing robots, how do you do it so that they're safe? And one thing that you want to do is, you know, I was talking earlier about top down versus bottom up. The best way to make a robot safe is bottom up, design it so that it cannot hurt anybody. It's either too weak to hurt somebody. It's in a position where you just never has a chance to hurt anybody, you know? And if you can't avoid that, then, you know, you've got to be ready with other safety measures with respect to that, you know. So for instance, if you're going to have a butler robot that walks around your house, don't make the grippers strong enough to crush a person's windpipe, you know. It's just a bad idea. There's no reason for it. So, you know, I think that a lot of that can be mitigated from just smart design decisions from the beginning.
But absolutely. I totally agree with that. But I think the real problem is just like current technology could easily get out of control, especially in the wrong hands, like nuclear weapons is a good example, right? You know, it can be used for good. It could be used for bad or, you know, or just don't use it at all. That's really good. But with robots, you know, I'm worried about like a country basically taking this technology and very easily turning very weak hands into a very incredibly strong and accurate hands. And that's where I think the real threat would be from something like this.
Yeah, I mean, a great example is with drones. You know, right now they're proliferating and lots of different countries are getting a hold of them. And, you know, if you want to, you can just throw a bunch of explosives onto a cheap little drone and then send it off crashing into something, you know. But this is sort of an issue that is prevalent with any technology. You know, it can always be used for good or evil. And so, you know, whenever you're building it, you just have to sort of trust humankind.
Yeah.
maybe that's profoundly stupid. Maybe that's not. You know, it's not for me to say, but I think that's what's happening typically, you know, at the research institutions.
And speaking of warfare, I mean, that creates a huge incentive for technologically advanced countries like the United States to develop military applications for robots because the public is okay if we, you know, if $1 million machine gets blown up on the front lines, more so than actual people getting killed. So there's a huge incentive to have drones or robotic weapons platforms or whatever doing, you know, going into harm's way. I mean, we would love it. Imagine if we could, you know, execute our foreign policy warfare without putting any actual people at risk, just our machinery. right?
Yeah, yeah. So Pete Singer wrote a book recently called Wired for War, where he goes into detail on all of this, you know, on how if you've got more money, you can just keep throwing robots at your enemy, and how, you know, people react to that sometimes. The enemy is sort of frightened by these faceless monsters, but a lot of other times they've found that the enemies actually think of the country that's utilizing these robots as weak, as cowards, you know, afraid to actually fight. And you know what? It's interesting, but I really prefer to think of this from a different perspective. The deal with robots is that they're designed really to interact with humans. That's sort of what a lot of robotics is about. So much research is going into robots that are going to be able to talk to us and understand our emotions and do all these things for us. And I'm wondering, you know, as we've watched how the war in Afghanistan and Iraq has changed, and it's become less about, you know, like this recent offensive on Marja, or however you pronounce it. They're actually saying, we're not trying to kill people, we're trying to just stabilize the region so that we can set up a government. And so I'm suddenly imagining, what kind of machine is good at interacting with other human beings? What kind of machine can you just give it a language or culture or customs? You know, humanoid robots, that's the sort of machine that's designed for interacting with humans. And I'm wondering, how long will it be before you have war zones that aren't being bombarded by swarms of futuristic robots? Because, come on, I've seen that a million times. How long will it be before there are humanoid robots that are wearing local clothes, speaking local languages, walking around patrolling as sort of invulnerable police, and basically doing what we've been trying to do, stabilize the region, you know? And the reason we've had such trouble is because it's really tough to take an Xbox playing 19-year-old Marine and suddenly say, oh, yeah, you need to know everything about the culture of this place where you're going. And, you know, it'd be great if you could speak the language. And also, if you could memorize everybody's face, you know, despite whatever racial bias you have from growing up in a place where you never see people that are dressed this way or look this way. If you could just do that, that would be really terrific. Oh, and also, if they shoot at you, don't shoot back. That would be really great. Yeah. You know, they're not really well suited to that job. So thinking of robot peacekeepers is what I'm thinking of, and it's much more interesting to me.
How long do you think it'll be before anything like that really is developed? I mean, it's like I feel like I've been waiting my whole life to see a real robot that can actually like live in a house with people and do stuff. Is that even like in the near future?
You know, I think that we'll see it in our lifetime. You know, I think that it's in the next 20, 30 years, that kind of a thing. But, you know, it's just such a, there's so many different problems that have to be solved simultaneously for that. And then there has to also be this huge benefit, you know, a huge chunk of our population is getting elderly and there's not enough younger people to take care of everybody. So this is the baby boomers are all retiring. And this is the way it is right now in the United States and in Western Europe and in Japan. And these just happen to be the places that are building robots. And so especially in Japan, where culturally you can't get away with neglecting your elderly parents, and also they have an incredibly low birth rate, there's this huge pressure to provide these friendly humanoid robots that are going to be our companions and be in our houses with us and be taking care of us as we lose our functional ability.
Yeah, I always thought that rather than designing a robot to look like a human being, that we would design those kind of household robots to look like pets. Like, imagine having a dog. It would be a lot easier to have a dog look realistic and friendly and cuddly than an actual person, and it could actually be your fire alarm and your alarm system, and also your assisting the elderly and communication device. It could do a lot of things. It could be walk your children to school, or I mean, the applications are actually pretty extensive when you think about it in that context, and it would be in a form we're sort of used to having in our house, and I think it would be a lot easier to make user-friendly than a really humaniform robot.
Yeah, there are a lot of like-minded roboticists that agree with you. One of my favorite robots, actually, is a Japanese robot called Paro, P-A-R-O. And, you know, it is really, really hard to make a perfectly human-like android. That's the holy grail. It's basically maybe even impossible. And then you have other stuff like dogs and cats. And in fact, you think that's easier, but that's really, really hard, too. I don't know if you've seen any of those, any creep show or animatronic cats. I mean, those things are pretty scary because we are pretty familiar with cats. So, yeah. And dogs. So Paro actually looks like a baby harp seal, which is something that we're not really that used to seeing. So we don't notice, we're less likely to notice little details that are off. And Paro is like the size of a lap dog, and it's covered in white hypoallergenic fur, and it kind of coos and wiggles a little bit. It's just this lump of plush toy, but it has cameras in its eyes. It senses your moods. It knows how long you play with it every day and how active you are. You know, it has physiological sensing in it. So, if you hold it close, it can sense your heartbeat and your skin temperature, stuff like that. You know, it's always trying to get as much information as it can. And the thing is just really freaking cute. I mean, I saw it at a conference and the guy just got it out and laid it on a table, and everybody in the room was basically fighting over who got to cuddle this, right. This robot. So, you know, embedding all that technology into really cute, slightly unfamiliar forms. That's the way to do it, I think.
How does that thing get around? I mean, the thing's got two flippers and a tail. I mean, the thing, it's not very fast, I assume, then.
No, you carry it around. Yeah, you got to carry it around.
But I agree with you, too. I think the functionality that will, you know, when these things get beyond the toy stage and we're starting to build in real functionality into them, I think one of the burgeoning areas is going to be caring for the elderly.
Yeah.
Because it's also, I think, an area where there's a great deal of potential. I mean, I was just thinking about, for example, of GPS in your car. Mm-hmm. You know, that's really great for people whose memories are not what they used to be. You know, if you're... Seriously, I mean, people can drive a lot longer if you don't have to worry about them getting lost. You know, they could always just say, take me home, and get turn-by-turn directions to get home.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's something I think people don't really notice so much, is that it's not a zero-sum game here. A lot of times the advances that are made in robotics can just as easily be adapted for human use. So there's physical stuff like exoskeletons where, and those are here right now. I mean, I've worn, the Berkeley exoskeleton, and it straps onto your legs, and yes, you suddenly can carry 200 pounds around. And that's strictly robotic, research that went into that. But then there's also, you know, memory prosthetics that are, you know, cameras that go into your glasses that do face recognition all day long, remind you of who you're talking to, stuff like that. So a lot of times, people get sort of threatened by all the new advances in robotics, thinking, oh my God, score another point for the robots, you know. But in reality, a lot of it, you know, you can pick it up and put it on.
Daniel, what do you think of Big Dog?
Yeah.
Man. Isn't it inspiring? It's just a four-legged robot that looks sort of like a big dog or maybe a small pony. I think it looks like a newborn horse, like a foal, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's basically out of Boston Dynamics. It is designed to follow around soldiers carrying lots of heavy backpacks. But the thing that – seeing Big Dog for the first time is like – the future just takes a running start and then just kicks you in the balls. You're just like, oh man, the future is here, because it moves. It moves exactly like a biological animal. And when the researchers kick it, you know, it stumbles, and you feel sympathy for it. And the sympathy comes from such a deep place, you know, inside your brain. It's just,
yeah. Watching the video of that, it made me think, you know, There definitely is something to be said about if other life forms evolve on another planet. I mean, if they're just dealing with gravity, they probably have to move like we move, because that robot moves like we move.
Yeah. No, this is something I am fascinated by, because the definition of robotic means that you move unnaturally, you know? And if roboticists continue to do their jobs and they continue to build machines that are really, really well suited for their environment, and environment includes, you know, the gravity on our planet, you know, the weather that we have, the terrain that we walk around on, the atmosphere that we have, you know, every aspect of the environment. You know, as robots get better acclimated to the environment, they're going to appear more natural because everything that's here already, everything that's been evolved for every single little niche that's out there, you know, has evolved over a long, long time to be able to solve that problem perfectly. And so we're constantly exposed to all these really great solutions to different environments in the form of insects and animals and just all the natural world. And as machines sort of step it up and start to reach their full potential, they're going to actually become much less robotic and become much more natural. You know, because the basic underlying principles for, you know, the mathematic principles about how you move your legs when you're balancing on ice, that stuff stays the same. It doesn't matter whether your leg is made of metal or whether it's made of, you know, bone and skin. Yeah. So, yeah, really fascinating.
Daniel, this has been awesome. What projects are you working on right now? It seems like The Works, is that still an ongoing concern at History Channel?
No, so The Works I finished filming, and that's airing reruns and so forth. What I'm doing right now is next month, well, actually April, I have a book coming out called Brojitsu, The Martial Art of Sibling Rivalry, in which I have formalized sibling rivalry and all the hanging spit fakes and noogies and, you know, all that entails. So that's, I finally did something with no robots. And then, the main thing I'm doing right now is I sold a book called Robopocalypse to Random House, to Doubleday. And I'm working on that book, and it got optioned by DreamWorks, and wow. They're sending me concept. I mean, it's just, yeah, it's amazing to watch this because I'm getting to actually explore this robot uprising from the perspective of real characters, you know?
Yeah, I can't wait to see that movie.
Wow.
Dude, awesome. I can't either. It's made for me.
Dude, you got to have me in that movie being killed by a robot. That would be awesome.
I know.
See what you can do about
it. Yeah, we all volunteer to be extras who get killed by robots in the movie.
All right. I'm just telling you, it's pretty horrific. they specialize in it. So,
awesome. Yeah. Awesome.
A lot of blood, a lot of screaming.
All right, Daniel, we really appreciate you spending some time with us. Thanks a lot, man.
Thanks for having me on. Listen to me blather. I had a great time.
Thanks, Daniel.
Thanks, Daniel.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, Steve usually does, but it's my turn to come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine, one fictitious. I will challenge our panel of skeptics to sniff out the fake, and you can play along at home. Are you guys ready?
Sure.
Oh, I'll play your game, you rogue.
Oh my god. That was awesome.
It's perfect.
Great. Yeah.
That's awesome. All right, ready?
Yeah. That was for you.
That was so good.
That was for you.
Item number one. Researchers believe that bacteria in ocean sediments are connected by a network of microbial nanowires similar to the popular movie Avatar. Item number two. Mid-level intelligent people have unnatural preferences and values that are novel in human evolutionary history. Item number three. NASA has announced it intends to build inflatable space stations and moon bases. Evan, you go first.
Well, bacteria in ocean sediments are connected by a network of microbial nanowires. I don't see why not. I think it's fascinatingly true. And then the next one is mid-level intelligent people. What does that mean? Like 100 IQ people?
They have.
Not telling you anything.
Not really intelligent and not really stupid, I guess.
They have unnatural preferences and values that are novel in human evolutionary history. They're able to take those factors and put them together and see that they kind of match up on a chart, I would assume. It's an interesting thought. NASA announced it intends to build inflatable space stations and moon bases.
That's right, that you can buy for your kid for $19.95 if you write to us here, blah, blah, blah. No, I would assume that you mean by that that they full-size, fully functional, real Megillas, inflatable space stations and moon bases. You know, I don't see why they wouldn't experiment with technology like that, intend to build them. Well, but don't we have to get to the, you know, don't we have to, like, reinvigorate our space program and get it to the point where we still have to figure out how to get back to the moon? You know, I think we're still working on that part of it. So I don't know if this is kind of cart before the horse right now, but I think they'd probably be working on that and some other things. I will say, though, given the choices that the mid-level intelligent people won, that one is fiction.
Okay. Steve?
Well, the bacteria in ocean sediments ones is very interesting. I have read previously that bacteria do communicate with each other, that colonies have a sort of meta intelligence where they can respond to the environment collectively. So that makes sense. I think, you know, the analogy to Avatar is probably a little gratuitous, but the rest of it seems fine. The mid-level intelligent people having unnatural preferences and values that are novel in human evolutionary history. Not exactly sure what you're getting at there, but I have some problems with that. I think, you know, maybe the mid-level intelligent people is the thing that you altered. I could see that people at the extremes of intelligence, you know, may display some psychological features that don't follow the usual rules of evolutionary psychology, whatever they are. But mid-level doesn't really make any sense. You would think if they were average that they would follow the established psychological trends. And then NASA has announced it intends to build inflatable space stations and moon bases. Why not? You know, that makes a certain amount of sense. It could be economical. You could, you know, pack them up into a small space and then inflate them with the air that you're going to need to breathe anyway once you get to your destination. So that kind of design, you know, I could see how that would make sense. As long as you have the right kind of materials, that would be strong enough and flexible enough, you know, to do that. So I don't remember reading anything about that recently, but that makes sense to me. So I will go with Evan and say that number two, the mid-level intelligent people being unnatural, is the fiction.
Okay, Bob?
Yeah, pretty much everything these guys have said, I agree with. With the bacteria, I mean, I don't think I would be hesitant to agree with most anything about bacteria. They are just so so amazing, so diverse. Yeah, I'm sure the comparison to Avatar is a little gratuitous. I'm sure it's not somehow self-aware and able to transfer one mind from a biological body to an avatar. But I've read about bacterial films that are quite incredible structures. So I could definitely see this happening. The inflatable space stations and moon bases, yeah, I mean, it makes perfect sense. You want to save weight because it costs about $1 trillion per ounce to get this stuff into space. Make it as light as you can. So just bring the structure with you that can be inflated. And I don't know if they would make it extra stiff somehow beyond just the inflating it with the oxygen or the air. But yeah, and moon bases, although I have read a lot about making moon bases out of the regolith, I think that would be even a better way to go. But yeah, I'm sure they could find some sort of inflatable scenario to work as well with that. So that makes perfect sense as well. The second one, yeah, it just seems to make sense that you would either be either very intelligent people or the other end of the spectrum and not necessarily the mid-level intelligence. So I'm going to say that one is fiction.
Okay, so trying to follow Steve's paradigm. You all agreed that researchers believe that bacteria and ocean sediments are connected by a network of microbial nanowires similar to the popular movie Avatar. And this one is the fiction. Just kidding.
Oh, you bastard.
Hey,
Steve, you guys does that? Do you?
That one is the science. The real article actually shows a picture from Avatar, and they did mention Avatar.
Well, yeah, that helps. Helps draw
eyes to it. So basically, you guys nailed it. The studies had been done on marine bacteria that generate energy by oxidizing the gas hydrogen sulfide, which is common in ocean sediments. And to do this, the bacteria need oxygen in the seawater. And what was happening was they found that when they removed the oxygen and then reintroduced the oxygen, the bacteria that was lower than the surface was actually getting communication, they believe, from the bacteria that was actually on the surface. So as soon as the outer layer of bacteria came in contact with oxygen, the bacteria that were a few centimeters down started to process as if oxygen were present.
Ah. Mm-hmm.
They were getting a signal, some type of communication.
Right.
So I thought that was incredibly interesting. And the fact that it had Avatar in it and everything, I had to pick it.
Bacteria are endlessly fascinating.
They really are.
Okay, the next one is you all also agreed that NASA has announced it intends to build inflatable space stations and moon bases, and this one is science.
Yay!
Yeah!
You guys clean sweeped me. So basically,
hey,
this is
the first one I've gotten right. First scientist I broke my 0%.
Yeah, right. Hey, Steve.
Oh, Steve, you were batting 1,000, man.
Welcome.
So on February 22nd of 2010, NASA had fleshed out its plans in a detailed budget proposal, and they posted the proposal on their website. And in one section, they outlined that balloon-like habitats can be larger, lighter, and potentially less expensive than traditional ones made of rigid metal walls. They could be used as space stations or eventually moon bases, and NASA may send inflatable structures to the International Space Station to test their metal, including their ability to shield against space radiation. You guys totally nailed that
metal
one.
As in M-E-T-T-L-E?
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
This yeah, I'm sure Obama is just like laughing at this. Yeah, people in space, I don't think so.
Steve.
Yes.
Science or fiction is difficult to
You have
create.
A newfound respect for me, don't you, Jay?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It is a lot of work. It's a lot of work.
I read science news for hours.
I do that
hours.
Every week.
I also, you know, you can't just read the title. You have to dig in a little deeper, take a look and see what the article is really about. And then the one that was the biggest pain in the ass was coming up with the fake.
Yes. Coming up with a plausible fake is
totally wrong.
That's
fake.
The hardest one. That's the hardest thing to do. It's always the one I do last as well.
But yeah, that was the last one that I did. And it took me a long time to find this article and the actual news article. The actual article says, intelligent people have unnatural preferences and values that are novel in human evolutionary history. So to quickly explain this one, the study published in March 2010, issue of peer-reviewed scientific journal Social Psychology Quarterly, they said that more intelligent people are statistically significantly more likely to exhibit social values and religious and political preferences that are novel to the human species in evolutionary history, specifically liberalism and atheism, and for men, but not for women, preference for sexual exclusivity correlate with higher intelligence. How about that?
Is that right?
So I thought that was very interesting.
So really intelligent guys are more monogamous? Is that what they're saying?
That's what they're saying.
So women should really highly value very intelligent men.
Yes.
Yeah, well,
somewhat
for
nerdy.
For that one aspect,
men.
But in general, the more intelligent people are, the more that they offer to their society because of these novel ideas that they come up with and, you know, thinking out of the box or whatever. And now that I read through these again, and I've gone through my first science or fiction, I think I could do it again much better because I saw how easy it was for you guys to vet out what was going on. And man, you guys nailed it. Steve, you even were like, I don't think it's the mid-level. You totally zeroed in on that, which really sucked for me because I'm sitting there like, damn, I didn't even like have a debate about it.
Well,
you guys unraveled the whole thing very quickly and easily.
Well, seriously, I mean, you know, having done this for almost coming up on 5 years now, you guys have gotten very good at it. It's getting harder and harder and harder to trick you guys.
Well, good job, guys.
Well, thank you, Jay.
Well done.
Thanks, Jay.
It's fun to take a vacation from doing that every now and then. I'll do it
from time to time, Steve. I'd like to try again.
Oh, we should each try it. We should each try it.
We should
mix it up a little bit more.
We should mix it up a little bit more. It's because that's what takes me longer to do that than anything else. each week. So I'm certainly
happy. So it was like
happy.
A week off for you this week.
It was.
Saying.
Well, I had more time to prep the other items, you know.
So, Steve.
Yeah.
Do you have a quote for us this week?
Yes, I do. I do have a quote. Since you ask. The only new ideas that are not subject to our skepticism or suspicion are our own.
Very good.
That wow. comes from Colin Hightower.
Hightower. It's that character from Police Academy.
Oh, my God.
The tall.
That's true. No. He is a well-known quote and quip writer from the United States.
Is he
often
now?
Often associated with the American conservative political movement. Served in the U.S. Army during World War II.
Sounds like a good man.
Okay. This is his most notable quote. People seldom become famous for what they say until after they are famous for what they've done.
Oh, that's interesting.
But ironically, yeah. this guy became famous for what he said more than anything else.
You see.
But I thought that was a good quote.
Johnny Watchtower.
Most skeptical of yourself.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, thanks for joining me again this week, guys.
Sure. Good episode.
Thanks, Steve.
Hopefully, Rebecca will be better rested for next week.
How about Daniel? What a great interview. That was a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun. The guy's pretty
good. He rocked.
Yep.
He's one of those people, like, flat out, we could have talked to him for 3-4 hours.
Yeah, easy.
Didn't even get started. Bob and I were fighting each other. I'm sure you're going to edit that interview way down, but Bob and I were fighting each other for talking time.
Yeah. Well, we definitely should get him back. There's lots of topics, lots of ground we didn't cover with him.
Hey, he said he might come to TAM. He's going to think.
Really? Well, that'd be great.
Yeah,
we could follow up with him there.
Remember, everyone, about the NexusCon, the Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism in New York, New York, April 17th. It's coming up. Go to the website, register, get your T-shirt. There's still slots open for the speaker dinner. You get to rub elbows with the SGU and the other speakers. James Randi is coming, DJ Grothy, and others. So,
hey, Steve, how do you spell that website?
NECSSCON.org.
We wanted to give mention and a shout-out to the folks at Podcast Beyond Belief, which is the official podcast of Foundation Beyond Belief. You can find them at foundationbeyondbelief.org and see all the good work that they're doing there. The hosts are John Paul Daig and Rob Tarr from Science-Based Parenting, Lori Tarr from Rational Moms, Elise Anders from Skeptic, we know her, and Heidi Anderson from She Thought. So they've launched a podcast, and their mission is...
Science-Based Parenting?
Yep.
Where did they get that name from?
Yeah, well, they told me that they got it from science-based medicine. It was deliberate.
And that's the tip of the hat.
Spreading the science-based meme, which is nice. There's also a science-based pharmacology blog. Now, the science-based meme is definitely taken off.
Correctly so.
That's good work, boys.
So give them a listen.
Oh, also, guys, I was interviewed this past week for the Pod Delusion, which is a weekly UK podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Just a brief little interview about Douglas Adams and how he's obviously our podcast is named after him and how he's affected us and what we think of him and stuff. So I did a quick little interview on that. I'm not sure when it's going to be uploaded, but be on the lookout for it.
Cool.
Yeah, we'll put up an announcement on the Rogues Gallery or somewhere.
Okay.
Well, thanks for joining me this week, everyone.
Thank you,
Shirley.
Steve.
Thank you. A lot of fun.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Oh, I'll play your game, you rogue.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkepChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.